Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 231, and it's March 6th, and we're going to start a new chapter today, I guess like most times, and it's the appendicular skeleton that we're going to start today. But first, what we're going to do is look at the schedule. So it is indeed March 6th. Appendicular skeleton, and we have some lab practicums today, both the 7:30 and 12:30, and then you're done with 25% of the class. And on Monday, we're going to cover joints, then Wednesday, skeletal muscle tissue, then we're going to move away from bones and get into muscle. Then we got a couple lectures on muscles, and then spring break, and then the next exam. And it's also the same week where we have the second practicum. And probably that's going to cover some other bones and some muscles as well. All right, so that's the schedule. Anybody have a question regarding the schedule? There. Turn on another mic. No questions? Okay. I'll put that away. And I'm going to look at this. All right, so what are we looking at there? Oh, I didn't need to see both ones. Yeah, that's the skeleton. And I asked this question before, how many colors do you see in this diagram? Yeah, forget about the black and the white. Okay, but there are two colors, and that represents the two major divisions of the skeleton, which are, and you could tell me, axial versus the appendicular skeleton. And today we're going to talk about the appendicular skeleton. All right, so if you got any questions about that, you got to see me. All right, so here is the upper appendage, here is the lower appendage, and there is something that helps attach these appendages to the axial skeleton, and they are called girdles. And a girdle is just is something that surrounds some kind of object. Okay, and here is the pelvic girdle, it's surrounding the pelvic cavity, and up over here is the pectoral girdle. These are, they're going to be, you're going to learn the names of some bones that make these girdles up. But they're on our body because they attach the appendicular skeleton to the axial skeleton. And let's just start with the pectoral girdle or the upper appendage. You guys got a question? No? Okay. I just don't want you to interrupt other people that are right around you. All right, so let's look at pectoral girdle. So we zoomed into the shoulder, and the two bones that make up the pectoral girdle are the clavicle, which is anterior, and it goes even laterally out to the side. And then here's the scapula. It's off to the side, right? And then it courses medially. And if you put two clavicles and two scapulas together, it like almost surrounds your upper thoracic cavity. That's why it's called a girdle. And here you can see a bone in the arm, and it's attached to the pectoral girdle, and that's how it's attached to your body. It's interesting that there's only one joint that holds the whole upper appendage to your body, and this is it right here. It's the manubrial clavicle joint, or clavicular joint. This little joint right here is the only thing that's really attached to your axial skeleton. But you're going to notice that there are muscles that go to all of these different bones. And it's the muscles that really stabilize the shoulder, not that particular joint. Here's a sign-in sheet. I forgot to pass it around, but I just remembered. Okay, so sign in, please. And I need to get another piece of paper to get that. That's working. This will do it. Okay, so we're going to look at the pectoral girdle first, then look at some bones in the upper appendage, and then do the same for the lower appendage. The anterior bone is the clavicle. You don't have to know too much about the clavicle, but you're going to have to look at it in lab because these figures can't do it justice. So now we're getting into the part of the class where you can't just study figures or illustrations in your book to really understand what these bones look like. You actually have to pick them up, turn them around, and then maybe you can use a figure or an illustration or a picture to review. But the initial learning should really be done with the actual bones. All right, so here is that clavicle, and both ends are kind of flared. Both ends are broader than the diaphysis, okay, but the sternal end is going to look like the opening of a trumpet or a clarinet. It's going to have a big, broad, three-dimensional aspect to it. And the acromial end is going to be flat. It's going to look more like a knife. But on this picture, they kind of look similar. But in real life, they're going to look a lot different from each other. One has a big circular projection, and this one is nice and flat. All right, so I think maybe that's all you have to know about this, is be able to identify which end and that it participates in the pectoral girdle. You might have to know the conoid tubercle, because it's going to articulate with a part of the scapula to stabilize the shoulder joint, but I'm not sure if that's it. So look at your lab list if you really have to know that. All right, so here is the clavicle. There is a nerve that goes underneath the clavicle right here, and there is a big, huge vein that goes right through here, and there's a big, huge artery that goes right through here. And could you tell me, take a guess at what the name of that vein, the name of the artery, name of the nerve is? Take a guess. And we just got done talking about the clavicle. And so it's going to be called the subclavian vein, subclavian artery, subclavian nerve, because it goes right underneath the clavicle. So again, that's just an illustration. Now, once you see these bones, get to name these bones, you'd learn a whole bunch of other kinds of anatomy automatically in the process. The other reason why I mentioned that is because if that artery gets severed, right, that will produce a massive hemorrhage. And it's interesting, and people break clavicles all the time, and you might be wondering, why is it that more people don't die from a fracture of the clavicle? And that's because of the shape, this S shape right here. When a clavicle breaks, and it breaks frequently, it always breaks anteriorly. It breaks to the outside of the body. If it were to break down, then it would damage those nerves, and then you'd lose the function of that particular arm, or you could bleed to death. So that's interesting that it has this S shape. Okay, the reason why it breaks frequently is because it's got no place to move. It's stuck very tightly between the manubrium and the acromion process on the scapula. It's just stuck in there. So any kind of force applied to the shoulder, this clavicle will snap, and it will snap outwardly. All right, the other bone that we're going to look at is the scapula. The scapula is in your back. So this is kind of a hard illustration to appreciate because we're looking through the thoracic cage to see it. So let's pull it out in isolation, and this is the scapula. You're going to have to look at this bone because it's got an anterior surface and a posterior surface, and I want you to be able to identify this as being the anterior surface and this being the posterior surface of the scapula. And I think you'll be able to figure that out pretty quickly because you brought your answer key in the lecture with you today. So if you feel your back, okay, you're going to feel this big bony prominence right here, and we call that the spine of the scapula or scapular spine. And on top of it, there's going to be a muscle, and that you can palpate. Down below it, you can palpate a muscle. All right, so you should be able to feel this scapular spine. And what do we call in anatomy some kind of object that holds something? What do we call? A fossa. Oh, and look, here's a supraspinous fossa. Here's an infraspinous fossa. Right? Supraspinous just means right above the spine. And so here is the supraspinous fossa. And there's a muscle in there. And guess what? Now you've learned the name of a muscle already. It's called the supraspinatus. Right? So that you don't have to know that for the, maybe for the next test if we cover muscles. I'm not sure. Yeah, we do cover muscles for the next test. Right? Supraspinous muscle. And then over here we have the infraspinous fossa. That holds something, and in particular a muscle once again. And that muscle is called the infraspinatus. Right? So knowing bones is really, really helpful. All right, so this is the posterior aspect, but this is the aspect of the scapula that you usually look at, but you're looking at somebody's back. Right? So make sure you don't think this is the front of the scapula or anterior view. Okay, at the tip, as we're moving laterally on the spine of the scapula, we get to a big, huge process right here that we call the acromion. The acromion process has a bunch of ligaments that help stabilize the shoulder as well as muscles attached to it, right? But it's mostly ligaments. And then here's the coracoid process. And again, that stabilizes the shoulder joint. There are ligaments that go across like this, and there are muscles that are attached to it. And it looks more like a beak on a bird, okay, compared to this big flat plate of the acromion. So I think you should be able to see the difference between the coracoid process and the acromion process. All right, the scapula also has some angles. Here's the superior angle. Here's the inferior angle. And then it's got some borders or margins. The margins that run very close to your vertebral column in the center of your body is this one right here. And since it's pointing toward the inside of your body, guess what we call it? The medial border, right? Not median. Median means in the middle. Medial means closer to some center point in your body. All right, so this means this is the lateral border, and then this one up over here is going to be the superior border when it's labeled. All right, so on this bone right here, where does your arm attach? Someplace along this medial border or someplace along this lateral border? Yeah, because where's your arm attached? Yeah, on the side and the lateral border of the scapula. You don't have an arm sticking out the middle of your back, right? It's toward the sides. So with a little inspection and thought, I'm sure you could see that. There is a depression in the scapula, and it's called the glenoid cavity. Sometimes it's called the glenoid fossa. Maybe that's a better term, glenoid fossa, because it's not very deep at all. It's very shallow. It's not like a bowl. It's more like a saucer that you would put a teacup in, right? And it's called the glenoid fossa. So let me use the word fossa. And so it's holding something. Could anybody take a guess what it is holding? It is holding the bone in your arm, which is the humerus. So the head of the humerus fits right into here. We're going to look at it in a little bit different perspective. So let's go back to that view, this one right here. What view is this once again? This is the view that you can't really see because I can't see through anybody. This is what, the anterior view? So if you go through your body from the anterior side, you would get to this view of the scapula. So this is the part that you can't rub, can't get a back rub right here. There's a fossa. We call this the subscapular fossa. We can't call it the infraspinatus because we use that on the other side. Plus, there's no spine over here. There's no spine on the subscapular fossa. Right? And there's a muscle in there called the subscapularis. So that's going to be helpful for you. And then here is the lateral border, medial border. Sometimes there's a notch right here. We call that the suprascapular notch. All right, so you could probably put that together just by knowing nomenclature. Here is that big bony prominence called the acromion process and the coracoid process. And then here is the glenoid fossa. It's not very deep. Okay, and I'm going to mention something about the depth of the glenoid cavity compared to the one that holds your lower appendage to your axial skeleton. And we're going to make a comparison. So just remember, this is not a very deep fossa at all. What else do I want to say about the scapula? That's probably pretty good. We got a couple different views. Does anybody remember how many fossae we talked about right now? Can you count them up? Yeah, there were a lot. More than one, right? But on this particular bone, we can't do like one and then many like we can with epithelia. All right, so what were they called? Here's one right here called the subscapular fossa on the anterior side. But what about that posterior side? Yeah, here's the infraspinous fossa. Here's the supraspinous fossa. All right, and then here's the fourth one, glenoid fossa. So there are four fossa that come together, three for muscles and one for a bone. Okay, and you can see all of these fossa really nicely on this lateral view, right? Here's the supraspinous fossa, infraspinous fossa, and then here's a really big subscapular fossa. And indeed, the subscapularis is a big muscle compared to these on the posterior side. Here's that glenoid cavity. So that's all four fossa you can see on this illustration. That's really nice. And there is a part of this joint. I don't know if we have a picture in your book. There's something that makes the depth of the glenoid fossa a little bit deeper. And it's made out of cartilage, so it's not as strong as this muscle, and it's called a labrum, right? So the glenoid labrum is some relatively soft tissue in the shoulder that stabilizes the shoulder, but if you ever injure your shoulder, that's one of the easiest things to damage, is the labrum, right? It's almost like a knee meniscus, but not quite, because it's only on the edge. A knee meniscus, Well, knee meniscus is only on the edges too. That's interesting. All right, I'll try to find a nice picture of the labrum for you. I just mentioned it even though I don't have a picture here because it's commonly injured. Okay, so that's the clavicle and scapula. And if you think of two bones, you should think of something else automatically. If you think of clavicle and scapula together, what is that? It makes something up. It makes up the structure that attaches your upper appendage to your axial skeleton. That's a description, but it's got a name too. Anybody remember the name? It's called the pectoral girdle. It's named after, okay, this pectoral region on you. Pectoral girdle. Pectoral girdle, clavicle and scapula, attach your upper appendage to your axial skeleton. All right, so we're ready to move on to some bones of the upper appendage. Like, for instance, here, and there's only one. So this is not for instance, this is actually it. And this is all it is, just one bone. So here's the proximal epiphysis. Down here is the distal epiphysis, right? And here's the diaphysis. Mid-diaphysis, there is a rough raised area. And usually we call that a process, but this is pretty big and very rough, and a big strong muscle attaches right here. All right, so instead of a process, we call it a tuberosity. If you palpate it with your fingertip, it's going to be rough. And in particular, it's the deltoid tuberosity. All right, could anybody maybe guess why it's called the deltoid tuberosity? Why deltoid? Because, yeah, there's a big, powerful muscle in your shoulder called the deltoid, right? And this is one of the attachment points for it. That's an important attachment point for the deltoid muscle. And this is kind of fun. And the deltoid muscle is named deltoid. Why do you think? Because, that's better, because it has a triangular shape which looks like a delta of the Greek alphabet, right? So a lot of times we name muscles by their shape. This is a really good example. And again, this is another good example of why you really want to pay attention to bones, because you learn so many other things right away in anatomy. All right, so the deltoid tuberosity is lateral on the bone, and I think you could probably tell that, and it's mid-diaphysis. That's really easy to see. And why do I know the deltoid tuberosity is lateral? Because if we look at the proximal epiphysis, here is that round, smooth surface that articulates with the glenoid fossa. And which way does this have to face? Can it face to the outside? Ooh, that would hurt really bad. No, it's got to face medially so that it can articulate with the scapula. So this is the medial side, and here is the lateral side of the humerus. All right, so this should resemble a ball, and the shoulder joint is a ball and socket joint, which means that you have a lot of flexibility. Ball and socket joints give you the most flexibility of any kind of joints in your body. But that also means that they're the weakest joint because they have the most flexibility. We call that a trade-off. Okay? You trade off things all the time. What happens if you want a vehicle that you want to carry a lot of furniture around in? Say you're at a stoplight and you're parked right next to a motorcycle and you're in your truck, which is really handy if you want to carry a lot of furniture around with you. But what happens when the light turns green and both hit the accelerator? What's going to happen? Compare a motorcycle to a truck. Who's going to get across the intersection quicker? Yeah, a motorcycle. All right, so the motorcycle is more sporty. It's kind of faster, a little bit more fun to drive than a big truck. But can you carry furniture around in it? No, you can't. So there's a trade-off, right? There's trade-offs in all the choices that we make. And the trade-off of the shoulder is that it is relatively weak, but it has a large range of motion. Okay, that's the beauty of the shoulder joint. This is the head of the humerus. It's just a condyle. And then right below it, there are some tubercles. These are processes as well. All right, and they have very rough surfaces, which means what? If you have a process that has a very rough surface, it's usually used to attach a muscle. And indeed, there are lots of muscles that attach to these two points. And we talked about a couple already, like the supraspinatus, infraspinatus, subscapularis. We're going to look at that probably next week or the week after. So here is a little tubercle, and here is a bigger one. And so we call this one the greater tubercle, and then here is the lesser tubercle. Look in your lab list to see if you got to know both of those. Oh, it's labeled here. Lesser tubercle. Great. Oh, they are labeled right here. Good. Okay. And there is a long depression that separates the greater and lesser tubercles. What do we call a long depression in anatomy? You can call it a groove, or you can call it a sulcus. Right? And in this part, and you could call this one, either way, I don't care, but in your book it calls it a sulcus, and that's really the more common term. And since it goes between the tubercles, we call that the intertubercular sulcus. Okay? Intertubercular sulcus. And that is for holding a very important tendon in your body that comes from the biceps muscle, which is anterior. That tendon goes all the way through here and inserts into the scapula. It goes all the way through the head of the humerus, path over the top of the head of the humerus. All right, so I'm going to have to mention that again. All right, so that's the proximal epiphysis on the humerus. And where do we find the humerus once again? Arm, okay. And are there any other bones in the arm? As a matter of fact, there are not, right? There's only one bone, only the humerus in the arm. There's only one bone in the arm. Oh, and somebody maybe should tell me, where is the arm located? Between your shoulder and your elbow only. Okay, you have many other bones in your upper appendage, but in your arm, you only have one, in proper anatomical language. All right, let's look at this distal epiphysis. We're going to look at this area in a couple of different views and maybe with respect to a couple of different bones, because the elbow joint acts like a hinge joint. It can flex and extend, right? You can move your hand up forwards and then backwards. But what else can you do with your hand? You can rotate it around like that. We're going to learn what that motion is called, and that happens at the elbow. So there has to be a special joint in the elbow, and you can see it looks a little bit more complicated than this ball and socket joint, because it has two separate condylar surfaces. There's one here that actually looks like a ball on one side, and then there's another one over here that has two broad ends. Here's the broad end of it, and here's the broad end of the other one, and then here's the skinny middle part of it. Kind of looks like an hourglass, maybe, but it really reminds me of a spool or a bobbin that you'd wind some kind of filament on. All right, this thing right here is called the capitulum. The spherical one is the capitulum. The one that looks like a spool is called the trochlea. And you got to be really familiar with these names, because we use these names to name some other parts of these bones. So we've got two condylar surfaces here. That should clue you in that how many bones are in the forearm? Yeah, there are two. Okay, there's one that articulates with the capitulum. You're going to have to know that one. And then one that articulates with the trochlea. And in lab, you'll have a really easy time putting those bones together to see how they fit together, because they fit together just perfectly. All right, so here are the condyles. And here's a depression. When your arm is flexed, the bone in your forearm rotates right around, and the head of the radius has to have a place to go, and it fits right in this depression of the humerus. And so we call that the radial fossa. And then over here is what we call the coronoid fossa. It's a depression that holds a part of the ulna. The ulna is the other bone in your arm, and you're really familiar with the ulna, because that's this point that's sticking out on your elbow. That point that's sticking out on your elbow is what we call the olecranon process, and there's another process on the inside, or the anterior side, okay, which you can't really see, but it's sticking out so that when you flex your elbow, that part of the ulna has to fit into this space right here, the coronoid fossa. And the name of that process on the ulna is called the coronoid process. Okay. So here are the condyles, the capitulum and trochlea, and there are some rough raised areas above or superior to these condyles, and guess what we should call those? How about epicondyle? What does epicondyle mean? It means that it's some kind of part of a bone that is above a condyle, so here are the condyles, and indeed it's above it. But if we look at these are going to be rough raised area on a bone, not smooth, so they are not condyles, they're just above the condyles, and these are used for muscle attachment as well. So these, it's just a special kind of process. So here's the medial epicondyle, and again you could tell because here's the head of the humerus, and then here's the lateral
super epicondyle here. Okay, something else that you'll notice is that the head of the humerus is very broad. It's a very strong muscle. It hardly ever fractures there. And then there's a little bit of a narrowing right down from the head. Right? And what do we call that narrowing on your body? Yeah, it's your neck. Okay, so here's your head, here's your neck, and guess what? We call that the anatomical neck because it's there, we can observe it, but again, it's a big, strong part of the humerus. It rarely fractures. But the place that likes to fracture is right around here, right below, just almost at the junction of the epiphysis and diaphysis. And so sometimes we call that the surgical neck because it needs repair a bunch of times. So here's the anatomic neck, here's the surgical neck because it fractures because it's a lot thinner. All right, let's look at the posterior part of this bone. And could you tell me medial and lateral? Like, what's over here? What side of the bone is this? Lateral. I like lateral because here's the deltoid tuberosity. And the medial side has to have what? Well, of course, the medial epicondyle, but there's a better way to know. Here is the head of the humerus. The head of the humerus has to be pointing in toward the midline of the body. So that's easy to tell. So here's that anatomic neck once again. Then distal to that is the surgical neck. And here's the greater tubercle. And on the other side, which we can't see, would be the lesser tubercle. Okay, radial groove, I don't think you have to know. But deltoid tuberosity, you have to know. Okay, so here it, we don't see the capitulum anymore, which would be over here. But we do see the trochlea. That's something that kind of looks like a spool. And right above it is a really big, deep fossa. And that fossa is there because the point of your elbow that we call the olecranon process on the ulna, when you straighten your arm out, it disappears. And guess where it disappears into? It disappears into this olecranon fossa of the humerus. All right? So that's just a handy way of remembering what these things are called. All right, so that's pretty good for the humerus. This is a nice illustration, a zoomed-in region of the elbow. Right, and we can see the capitulum once again. We can see the trochlea. Capitulum looks like a sphere, and the trochlea kind of looks like a spool or a bobbin. Right, and we can see the epicondyles once again. The capitulum articulates with the radius. And the capitulum, I can't show you the whole picture unless I go backwards. What aspect of the humerus is the capitulum on? Is it medial or lateral? The capitulum is lateral and the trochlea is medial. So let's get to the next couple of slides. So here's the capitulum, and we said that was lateral, right? So if we look way up over past the top of the slide right here, you'd see the humerus, the head of the humerus poking in this direction. So here's the capitulum, here's the trochlea. So the capitulum is lateral, matches up with the radius, that's a bone in the forearm. Okay, and in the forearm, what bone is that going to be? Is that going to be a medial bone or a lateral bone? Because the capitulum is lateral, the radius is the lateral bone in your forearm. So in anatomic position, the radius is way out over here. You have another bone in the forearm, which is medial, which is way over in here, right? And that's going to articulate with the trochlea, and that's what we call the ulna. So here's the ulna bone. All right, so here's that coronoid process that I promised you to see. And then here's the coronoid fossa within the humerus that accepts the coronoid process when you flex your elbow. And then here's the head of the radius that has to fit into this radial fossa, okay, again, when you flex, because there's got to be a spot to it, otherwise something would fracture. All right, so the elbow joint is really interesting, and you're going to have to apply yourselves to really remember what these structures are. But in lab, put them together, look at the skeleton, check these figures out, do the drag and drop exercises in Blackboard, and I think you'll be able to put it together and really appreciate this joint. Okay, here is just the posterior aspect of the elbow. Here is, and now we switch sides, so lateral is over here, medial is over here, and what bone is lateral in the forearm? Maybe you haven't memorized that yet, but I want to just go over and over and over and over it. Okay? And the lateral, remember, your arm has to be in anatomic position so the thumb is facing which way? Laterally. Okay, so you got to be in that position. So lateral bone in the forearm is going to be the radius, the medial bone is going to be the ulna. And that's really handy to get that straightened out because there are arteries and veins and nerves that are way over here that are lateral in your forearm. And guess what we're going to call those? Radial. Radial artery, radial nerve. And then over here, we're going to call that the ulnar nerve, for instance. Okay. So it's really handy to know your bones, once again. All right, so here is the olecranon process. And when you straighten your arm out, we call that extension. That olecranon, and you can palpate your elbow. When you extend your arm all the way out, that olecranon process kind of disappears. I can feel it right now, and then it disappears. It has to go into the olecranon fossa of the humerus. Okay, on the other side was the coronoid process. All right, so that's a little bit about the elbow joint. And here are exactly the two bones in the forearm. So laterally, we have the radius. Medially, we have the ulna. And it's the ulna that makes up, at least on the surface, what you appreciate in your elbow. Right? And what you appreciate is this big olecranon process right here. Okay, and here is the trochlear notch, and guess what fits right into the trochlear notch? You're going to see that the trochlear notch actually looks like a hook, and it hooks on to what part of the humerus? It hooks on to the trochlea. So that, and that's really handy that they didn't mix those terms up, right? So if you know the trochlea, you know the trochlear notch. Here's that coronoid process once again. And then here are the two diaphyses of the ulna and the radius. And then here's a little membrane that helps stabilize these two joints. But this is a movable joint, so this is not like a suture. This allows motion, right? It's, and we just call that the interosseous membrane because it exists between the two bones in the forearm. And also, there's also one between the two bones in the leg as well. Okay, and it has to be movable because you can do this with the palm of your hand. If these two bones were, if the ulna and radius were glued together, then you wouldn't be able to do this motion at all. All right, so here is the head of the radius. It's very circular, and there's a fossa on the top of it. You don't have to know the name of the fossa that slides right over the capitulum very nicely. But since you can move your hand backwards and forth like this, it means that the radius has to twist. And it twists, here, and that's why the head of the radius is nice and round. So it allows some rotation, and the part of the ulna that accepts, it's a little dimple that accepts the head of the radius, okay, is called the radial notch. And the radial notch exists on the ulna, right? Just like how we name processes. We don't name the process by the bone that it's on, but by the bone that it is touching. So this is pretty much the same nomenclature. If we look at the ulna, it has a notch right here, and we're going to call that the radial notch because it is touching the head of the radius. All right, then down over here, here's the distal part of the ulna, and in particular, this is, we also call this the head of the ulna, even though it's upside down because it's round. It has to rotate up against the radius, and so there is a notch down over here, right? And since this is the radius, we don't want to call that the radial notch, right, because that's the bone. It's the ulna that is touching the radius. The notch is in the radius, so what would we want to call that smooth surface right in there? That's a notch. Okay? Down over here, it's on the radius, but it's touching the ulna, so we call that the ulnar notch. So here's the ulnar notch, and up over here is the radial notch. All right, the diaphyses are pretty easy to understand as long as you know what bone is medial, which bone is lateral. And then down over here, there are a couple little bony prominences, both medial and lateral. Medially on the ulna is what we call a styloid process, similar to this, it's actually the same name as the styloid process that's on the temporal bone. And there's also a styloid process on the lateral side of the wrist. And you can actually feel those processes on either side of your wrist. And guess what the function of those processes are? And you could say muscle attachment, and you would be right. Okay. Okay. So I think that's pretty good for the ulna and radius. Here's just a posterior view, and again, here you can see that big elbow bone in the elbow, right? Olecranon process of the ulna. Again, interosseous membrane, the styloid processes, and of course, this is the lateral bone, and then here is the medial bone. Okay, who could tell me what bone this is? I see a big notch right here that looks like a hook. What bone is this in? It's in the ulna, and this is the hook that fits right around the, what is this articular surface called? That's the trochlea. All right, so here's the trochlear notch of the ulna, just reaching in and grabbing right around the trochlea of the humerus. This makes up the elbow joint, or part of the elbow joint. All right, I have the head of the radius right here, and it's going to fit right into this part of the ulna, but we don't call that the ulnar notch. Because the radius is touching right here, we're going to call that the radial notch. Right, that's on the proximal end of your forearm, and then down on the distal end, there's another notch down here as well. This notch, however, is in the radius, and that is touching the ulna, so we're going to call that the ulnar notch of the radius. Kind of the same nomenclature. Okay, so one thing I didn't mention, here's that coronoid process that has to fit into the coronoid fossa of the humerus when you flex your arm, like so. Okay, wrist. All right, so wrist is a nice proper term. And I'm not going to ask you to know the names of these surfaces, but you should know this is a styloid process over here. Right, but we are interested in knowing something about the wrist. So let's just go to the wrist. Okay. So I see, here's a nice radiograph. I can see bones of the wrist. And how many bones are there? Is there one? Is there two? There are many. Okay. There are many. And I'm not going to ask you to name the bones in the wrist. All right, but you should know that there are 8 of them. And one I do want you to know is the scaphoid right here. So I see the scaphoid here and scaphoid right here. It has a narrowing right in this region, right here and here, so that when you fall and you catch yourself with your hands, that's the bone in your wrist that takes all of the weight, takes most of the weight, and so it fractures, unfortunately. So the scaphoid is important for you to know because it does fracture. And when it fractures, it rips the artery that supplies oxygen and nutrients to this particular bone, so there's a little bit of a hemorrhage, and that artery typically does not grow back. It doesn't grow back into the scaphoid right here. All right, so what kind of tissue is the scaphoid? Anybody remember what kind of tissue the scaphoid is made out of? Yeah, it's bone connective tissue, right? Is it living or dead? It's living, right? There are osteocytes in there. But then when we cut off its oxygen supply, what happens to all those osteocytes? Yeah, they croak because they don't have any oxygen. They don't have any nutrients. And so they can't then rebuild this bone the way that it was, right? It just never grows back the way that it should be. So after somebody breaks this scaphoid, they really have a motion deficit in their wrist really for the rest of their life as a result of that. Okay? So bad things can happen to your skeleton. So here are the bones of the wrist. All of these together are called something, and I do want you to know that name. And together they're called carpals. A scaphoid is an example of one of the carpals. And carpals make up what part of your body? Okay. In this particular illustration, I see the forearm here. I see the wrist right here. Then I see the hand made out of these bones, and then these bones up over here make your digits. A digit and a finger are the same thing, but we don't really call them fingers. We call them digits. All right, so carpals make up what part? Not the forearm, but the wrist. Okay, carpals make up the wrist. All right, and then the bones that make up the hand are these right here. Are these labeled? Yeah, they're labeled on this slide. These are what we call meta-something. Metacarpals, because carpals you find in the wrist. And how many metacarpals do you have? Yeah, there are 5. And you got to know how to name them. They do have names, but it's not fancy names like capitate and pisiform and triquetrum and all that. All right, they just have a number. And you number these from lateral to medially, and of course, lateral means you start with the thumb. So thumb is the number one metacarpal, index finger is number two, okay, and your little finger, notice I hopped over a couple, your little finger is number five, metacarpal, and that completely describes it, but you might have to say right or left. On a practicum, I won't make you know right and left for bones. Some parts I will, but not for bones. But I could give you a test right now on right and left. Who wants to take that test? I gave the lab that already, so you guys know it. Nobody wants to take a test? It's pretty easy. I want to give you a test right now. Okay, raise your left hand really fast. Okay, you guys are good, good, good. Okay, so you know right from left. Excellent. So I won't test you on the lecture exam for bones. Everybody passed that. So these bones right here that make up the palm of your hand are called what? Okay, metacarpals. Bones that make up the wrist are carpals. So you got carpals, metacarpals. And then you have bones that make up the digits. A digit is not a bone. A digit is just your finger. Okay, so these bones that make up the digits, starting right here, these are what we call phalanges. Each one is called a phalanx, singular. So here is a phalanx. All of these together are phalanges. And you can see that in some digits, like number two, there are three bones that make up that particular digit. There's a distal, which means what? Farther away. Here's the one in the middle. And then here's the proximal one, which is what? The one that's most closely attached to your hand, to these metacarpals right here. So you got a proximal, middle, and distal. And you should know that this is number two, then number three, then number four, then number five. Okay, I'm going to quiz you on that in just a second. But let's go to the thumb first. The thumb, I see a proximal phalange right here and a distal. I don't see a middle. But if you look at your hand, which digit is the shortest? It really is your thumb. Okay, and that's because it only has two phalanges. Right? And your little finger has three. Right, so your thumb is kind of small because of that. All right, so digit number one only has two. The remaining four have three phalanges. All right, so could you name this one right here? What's the name of this bone? Start with a number. Number four. Oh, yeah, well, on the practicum, I won't have these numbered down here. So make sure you know how to count from lateral to medial, from the thumb, right, back to the little finger. So here's number four. Number four, what? Proximal phalanx. Yeah. So that's how you name that. And what about this one here? Number four, middle phalanx. And then here is the number four, distal phalanx. Yeah, so you know how to name all these bones. And we're going to use the same nomenclature for the digits that make up your foot, too, as well. We'll get to that in just a second. Okay, so does anybody have a question? This seems really easy. All right. When I talk about it, it probably seems really, really easy, but if you don't look at this soon, okay, you're going to forget this nomenclature, all right? So make sure you got to just study a little bit every day. That will make anatomy a lot easier if you do that, because a lot of students on practicums and even on the lecture exam forget how to label these things, but right now you're thinking, well, gee whiz, it's really simple, okay? But I think it's easy to forget as well, all right? So it is simple, but don't forget it. All right, so that's your whole upper appendage right there. And in lab next week, we're going to start to look at these bones of the upper appendage and probably start with not the humerus, but something that's even more proximal. What's the most proximal segment of the upper appendage? What's that called? And we got to know the names of those bones. It's called the pectoral girdle, right? And what are the names of the bones that make the pectoral girdle? Clavicle and scapula, right? And there's two of them, so they kind of encircle your upper thorax, and so that's why it's called a girdle. They help attach this upper appendage to your axial skeleton. Okay. All right, so let's move on to the lower limb, and the lower limb has a girdle as well, but it's called the pelvic girdle. And here is the pelvic girdle. It has a couple bones. These are what we call adcoxae. right, or coxal bones. Either one of these I would accept, and there's two. Here is the right one, here's the left one. But this is really not part of the pectoral girdle, this is sacrum. What is the sacrum a part of, if it's not part of the pelvic girdle? Yeah, it's part of the vertebral column. So it's really what? Axial skeleton. We just include it on this illustration of the appendicular skeleton, even though it doesn't belong, because it's so intimately connected with the coxae. Okay. So you can kind of forget about the sacrum, but you should know that from when we looked at the axial skeleton. Okay, each coxae during development was actually three bones that have fused together. And superiorly, that bone is called the ilium. That's one. Then anterior, this is the pubis. And then the bone that you're all sitting on right now, which is posterior, a little bit anterior, but it's the most inferior bone because you're sitting on it, we call that the ischium. Right? And when something gets low on oxygen because you're compressing these muscles right here, we say those muscles become ischemic. Right? Or if you have ischemic heart disease, that means that your heart isn't getting the oxygen that it needs. So we call this the ischium because it's kind of pushing out the blood supply to some muscles that are in this region of your body. All right, so these three bones make up the coxae, and you're going to have to really pay attention to these in lab. It's almost impossible to understand this bone if we just look at an illustration. Okay, but we can look at a couple things. All right, here is a large depression. And this depression is in an coxae, and it's partly in the ilium, partly in the pubis, and partly in the ischium. So you can't really say what bone it's in, except for coxae, because all three are needed to make it. And it's a lot deeper than the, what's the fossa in the scapula for holding the humerus? Anybody remember what the fossa in the scapula that holds the humerus? It's called the glenoid fossa, and it's not very deep. It's not like a bowl. It's more like a saucer, right? It's very shallow. And if you compare it to this depression right here, you're going to see that this depression is very deep. And this, and because of that, we give it a special name. We call it the acetabulum. Acetabulum here, right? So the head of the femur, which is round, just like the head of the humerus, fits very deep into the socket. So what does that mean? It means two things, and they're trade-offs from each other. It makes it different than the shoulder joint. Remember, shoulder joint, a lot of range of motion, but weak. So what does that mean for the hip? Less range of motion, but what does that give you? A lot of strength and power in the hip. Okay, so again, that's that trade-off, and you can see by anatomy, the reasons why for that, because the acetabulum is very deep. Okay, so that's a good place to start. Here is the obturator foramen, not labeled on this slide, but probably labeled on another slide someplace. All right, so here is that ilium once again, and here we see that it forms like a bowl on the anterior side. So we're looking from the anterior side of somebody. It forms a bowl. What do we call a bowl in anatomy? Fossa, and since it's on the ilium, we call that the iliac fossa. And the bowl is for holding something, and it holds sometimes pelvic organs or maybe parts of the digestive tract. So it's got to be there. Okay, here is, and when you palpate this in lab, and you can see it on this picture, it's a very rough surface, and it's raised off of the ilium. What do we call a rough raised area on a bone? A process. But if it's really long like this, we give it a fancier name. It is a process, but it's also a crest because it's really long. It's a process. And what's the function of a process and then also a crest? Muscle attachment. Yeah, big, powerful muscles. Of course, you probably would suspect that because we said that the hip joint is a very strong, powerful joint, right? So we're going to learn some muscles that attach right there. What else should I show you? Oh, okay. There's a joint between the pubic bones, and this is called the pubic symphysis. There's cartilage in here, and normally it's an immovable joint. It doesn't move. I don't see anybody's pubic symphysis moving in here, but there is a time when it does move, and that's during childbirth or parturition, right? This cartilage is dissolved away, and that allows dissociation or disjunction of these two bones that enlarges, right, what I see right here, Okay, this is what we call the pelvic inlet, and if we look from the underside, that would be called the pelvic outlet. And so that just allows for easier delivery. And then after delivery, then the pubic bones come back together and the pubic symphysis reforms, and it mostly comes back together, but probably not exactly the way it was. Okay, what else? I need a different view to tell you about some of these things right here. So let's see if we can look at this. So what kind of bone is that? Okay, don't look for parts of this bone. Let's just start by, if you can tell me what the name of this bone is. It's bizarre, right? So let's just, that's a good way to remember this bone. This is the os coxae. Okay, this is an os coxae or coxal bone. And remember, to make a pelvic girdle, you need two of these things, one on the right, one on the left. All right, and here I see the acetabulum, very, very deep. And again, within the acetabulum, I can see part of it's made from the ilium, part of it's made from the ischium, part is made from the pubis. It's probably different colors to you guys. And it's very deep, right? But what side, then, if this is the acetabulum, what side of the os coxae is this? Is this medial or lateral? Lateral, because your legs are off to the side, right? So the head of the femur is going to attach laterally on an os coxae. So this is a nice lateral, and it says right here, lateral view of a hip bone. Okay, there are some processes on the os coxae, as you would imagine, because there's big, strong muscles that allow you to walk and stand up straight. This is the anterior side of an os coxae, and one way to know that is because here's the pubic bone. The ischium is posterior, so here's the pubic bone. So here is the anterior iliac spine. A spine is just kind of a narrow process used for muscle attachment. And here's another anterior spine on the ilium. Both of these are on the ilium. One is superior, one is inferior. So since they have both the same name, we have to add what? Superior and inferior to their name, so that for sure we know the difference between them. So here is the anterior superior, it's on the iliac spine. Here is the anterior inferior iliac spine. And that's going to be on the anterior side of the os coxae. Right, if we stay on the ilium, but move to what side? What side am I moving the cursor to? If this is anterior, this side is posterior. And here are a couple more spines on the ilium, and one is above the other. So this is the posterior, because on the posterior side of the ilium, posterior superior iliac spine. Here's the posterior inferior iliac spine. Now there's another way to tell what the posterior side of the ilium is, because I see this big, huge notch right here. And I see another little one here. Maybe that's hard to miss, but this big one is impossible to miss. And we call this the greater sciatic notch, because it associates itself with what? The sciatic nerve. This is the greater sciatic notch, here's the lesser. Okay, that's going to be on the posterior side of an os coxae. There's something that separates the greater sciatic notch from the lesser sciatic notch, and it is right here. What bone is this thing on? It's a process, it's sticking up off of the bone, right? But what bone of the three that make an os coxae, which one is this? Yeah, it's the ischium. So we can't call that an iliac spine because it's not on the ilium. It is on the ischium. So we just call that the ischial spine, and thank goodness the ischium only has one spine, so we don't have to name it anything else, right? So we just call that the ischial spine. Make sure you can find this one in lab. That's really easy to forget for some reason. A lot of people call it a superior or an inferior ischial spine or something like that, but you know, it's just plain old ischial spine. All right, here's that obturator foramen once again. This thing here that kind of looks like a fan reminded somebody of a wing of some kind of creature. I don't know what kind of creature. I might not see a wing in this illustration, but Allah means wing. So here is a wing, or maybe a fan. Maybe wing and fan have the same word but different connotations in some language, I'm not sure. So here is the Allah that kind of looks like a fan, but on the inside of the Allah, can anybody remember what we had on the inside? The medial aspect of this Allah right here was the, let's go take a look. Here's the Allah once again, fan shape, but on the inside of medial side, it forms a fossa or depression. So we call that the iliac fossa because the olla is part of what bone? It's part of the ilium, as we can see over here on this illustration. All right, we can see the spines once again. All right, so, we're on this one. No, we were on this one. We're done talking about this one. Okay, so let's go to the medial side of an ascoxae. And again, I can see the spines. Okay, and then here's the sciatic notch, so that's a dead giveaway. This is the posterior part of an ascoxae. Here's the pubic bone. That's kind of a nice giveaway. This is the anterior side. And I see the two spines on the ilium here, and since here's the greater sciatic notch, here is the posterior iliac spine above the other posterior iliac spine. So you got superior and inferior posterior iliac spines. Then on the anterior side, again, here's the superior, here's the inferior anterior iliac spines. Okay, here's a little practice. Here is the body of the pubis, okay, right in here. And then it makes a 90 degree bend from the body. It makes another 90 degree bend down over here. What do you call a 90 degree bend from something? A ramus. Yeah, so here is a superior ramus, here's the inferior ramus of the pubic bone. And this is part of the joint that makes up the pubic symphysis. Oh, here, finally, obturator foramen. There is a very rough area right here called the ischial process? I got a feeling. Ischial tuberosity. Wow, I forgot what this is called. Okay, a tuberosity is a process. Okay? Ischial tuberosity. And I don't want you to forget, I was thinking of the muscles that attach right here. Okay, but it certainly is a tuberosity, which is a little bit bigger than a tubercle. All right, and big, powerful muscles attach right here. And some of them we're going to call the hamstrings. We're going to learn some of the names that make up the hamstrings right here. That's why it looks so rough in this area. All right, so I think that's all I need to say about the ascoxae. And a way to begin to study this in lab is find the medial surface or find the lateral surface and put it on your body the way it belongs. And once it's on your body, it will kind of click in what's anterior, what's posterior, and all that kind of stuff. But if you just hold it up and twist it around, it's going to be really hard to understand this bone. So model it on your body. As a matter of fact, take a scapula and model it on your body as well. Put it on your back, or your lab partner's back, so you can see clearly what the anterior side is, what the posterior side of the scapula is like. Okay, I'll mention that a number of times once we get into lab. All right, so what do the two ascoxae, what do they form? They make something. The pelvic girdle. Yeah, the pelvic girdle, which helps attach the lower appendage to your axial skeleton. As a review, okay, I know some of you guys had a practicum already or you're thinking about the practicum, but as a review, what are the bones that make up the pectoral girdle? The clavicle and the scapula, yeah. So you become familiar with that in due time. All right, so come on, cursor. Let's go back to this figure. All right, so the cavity that fits inside the pubic bones or the two ascoxae in the sacrum right here, we call that the pelvic cavity. And there's different ways that we can define what the pelvic cavity is. There's nothing that really separates things in the abdominal cavity from the pelvic cavity, so we have to make a construct in our mind. All right, if we take our hand or draw a line from the iliac crest down to the pubic bone, which includes all the organs in the iliac fossa right here, we call that the false pelvis. That's an extension of the pelvis. All right, but if we look at, this is called the arcuate line. Cursor. Here's the arcuate line. If we then draw a line from across the pelvis from this arcuate line, we have a smaller cavity. That's what we call the true pelvis. And that's what this illustration was attempting to show you right here. Okay. So the true pelvis is right through this arcuate line. Here you can see the arcuate line. And the false pelvis would come from what? From the sacral crest down to the pubic bone. A little bit different kind of cavity. If you enter the true pelvis from the superior part, we call that the pelvic inlet. If you enter the pelvic cavity from this inferior aspect, then that's what we call the pelvic outlet. Okay, and of course the pelvic outlet is very important for childbirth. In lab we're going to see how that's enlarged, namely because of the arrangement of the sacrum and the coccyx right here. True and false pelvis. Oh, maybe it's color-coded for you guys. Nicely. That's a really good illustration. Okay, how about, now that we have some symmetry between the arm and the part of your body between your hip and knee. What do we call that between your hip and knee? That's your thigh. Yeah, it's not your leg. All right, but this is your arm. That's your thigh, not your leg. You have one bone. Just like in your arm, you have the humerus. Okay, you have one bone in your thigh, and that's called the femur. That's the biggest, strongest bone in your body, longest as well. And there's a little bone that makes up the knee. I don't know why they mentioned that first. Let's look at a femur first. All right, so here is that long bone in the thigh. Here's the proximal epiphysis, here and here. Here is the head. It's this a round condylar surface, just like the head of the humerus. But you can see it's a lot bigger, and it's a lot more spherical. And so it can insert into the pelvic bones a lot farther, making the hip joint really strong. So here's the head. The head also has a little depression in it right here called the fovea capitis. Capitis means toward the head. Fovea means a little pit or depression. And that's where a big, powerful ligament goes from the head of the femur to the acetabulum, which further stabilizes the hip joint. So that's an important thing. The other thing that's important about that is that there's also an artery that comes from your body into your appendicular skeleton through the fovea capitis. And when the head of the femur is damaged, just like the scaphoid, that blood vessel gets damaged. And then what happens to the head of this femur right here? It dissolves away just like that scaphoid does after it breaks and it can't be repaired. All right, so now you have this big jagged edge someplace on this proximal edge of the femur, right? And then you need a hip replacement because it's just not going to work in the acetabulum. It's just going to grind away the acetabulum and it will hurt so bad you probably can't even walk, right? And there is an athlete who was so fantastic, he played two sports professionally, two kinds of sports, and he damaged his hip. Probably somebody tackled him from the side really, really hard, damaged the hip, and damaged that artery that went into the head of the femur, and it dissolved away. Well, could you play any kind of sports at all if you just have a jagged edge of a femur right here? No, you have a hard time walking around even, right? So he had a hip replacement, and as a matter of fact, he was so good of an athlete, he was able to go back and play professional baseball even with an artificial hip. He didn't ever want to go play football again, which is probably a good idea. Okay, but he could play professional baseball. He was just a super, super athlete. And I forget his name, so I hope somebody in here knows who that is. Who's that? Yeah, that was Bo Jackson. Yeah, it came back to me. Thank you. Bo Jackson. Amazing, amazing, amazing athlete. Okay, so if you know a family member that needs a hip replacement because they can't walk anymore because their hip is so bad, on an x-ray you could tell that the head of the femur is dissolving away or has dissolved away, then encourage them to get a hip replacement because it is a really nice, successful surgery. Okay? So there's really nothing to fear that kind of surgery, but don't get one unless you need one, of course, right? Okay. So just like on the humerus, you had the tubercles. Here you have some tubercles, but they're even bigger and more massive than what we find on the humerus. So we call these trochanters. Here's the greater trochanter. Here's the lesser trochanter. Here's the head. Here's a narrowing between the trochanters and the head. That narrowing, again, we just call the neck of the femur. And that's, it fractures here. So that's the surgical neck as well as the anatomical neck. And because it's both, we don't call it one or the other. We just call it the neck, as opposed to what we find on the humerus. Linea aspera is a crest, a process that runs down the shaft of the humerus on the posterior side. And again, that's for muscle attachment. So kind of remember linea aspera. Guess what linea means? Just means a line, okay, that you can palpate with your fingertip. So that's pretty good for this proximal epiphysis. The distal epiphysis on the femur is not nearly as complicated as the distal humerus, thank goodness, because your foot can't do this kind of motion, right? Your foot, we call that pronation and supination. You can't do that at your ankle or at your knee joint. All right, so here is a nice smooth surface. What do we call a smooth surface? A condyle. All right, so here's a lateral condyle. How could you tell me this is a lateral condyle? In particular, lateral. Because if you look up over here, yeah, the head of the femur is going to be medial. So here's the lateral condyle. Here's the medial condyle. Right, here's the intercondylar notch or fossa. There's some important ligaments that attach right up in here. Probably you all have heard of these. They're cruciate ligaments. In the next chapter, we're going to look a lot into the structure of this knee because it sustains a lot of damage in a lot of different cases. All right, so here's the condyles. And then what do we call this process above the condyles? Epicondyles, just like in the humerus, lateral and medial epicondyles for muscle attachment. Okay, so that's it for the posterior part of the femur. On the anterior part, the condyle, the medial and lateral condyles kind of fuse together because there's another bone that fits right in here that you don't have in your upper appendage. Yeah, and that's the patella. And the patella you see right here, and it kind of looks roughly triangular. So the more pointy end, which is pointing inferiorly, is what we call the apex of the patella. Okay, and then here's this whole surface is very rough, so that means that there are muscles that attach to the patella, especially thigh muscles attached to the patella, and then there's a ligament that goes from the patella down to this bone in the leg, which you're going to see is called the tibia, right? And we just call that the patellar ligament. So again, that ligament is attached to the patella, and that just helps the mechanical operation of the knee, right? When that ligament gets poked out away from the knee anteriorly a little bit, away from the knee joint. It stabilizes the knee. So here is the here's the posterior surface, which is the condylar surface. Here's the anterior surface, which is the rough surface on the patella. Okay, we're into the leg. How many bones do you have in the leg? Think of your upper appendage. Yeah, there are two. The patella really doesn't belong to the thigh or the leg. It's kind of like right in between. All right, but let's think about that upper appendage one more time. There are two bones. Which one is lateral? It's okay if you don't know right now because, yeah, that's the radius, and then the medial one is the ulna. Yeah, and that's almost easy for some people to remember or memorize because sometimes you take a pulse on somebody right above their thumb, and a lot of times they'll call that the radial pulse. Sometimes they call it a distal pulse because it's far away, but sometimes it's called the radial pulse because why? It's palpating the radial artery that goes right along the radius bone. Okay? So a lot of things kind of fall together in anatomy. All right, so in the leg, just like in the forearm, there are two bones. There's a medial and lateral one. So let's take a look at these. It's harder to remember which one is medial, which one is lateral. But there's a way you can tell because you have the study guide. Your body is the study guide. You can tell just by palpating your body which one is which. So you can reach down and touch commonly what we call the shin, but touch the anterior part of your leg. Okay. Let me see if I got it right. Yeah, and I can feel right this crest, right, the tibial crest right here. And when you bonk your leg on something, this is a narrow part of your bone that gets crushed that hurts really bad. Right, and if you hit it really hard, then you have a really nasty contusion right there. But hopefully you don't ever hit it really hard. That is the tibia. Okay, there's so much muscle around this other little bone that you can't feel it. So the one that you can feel right here is the tibia, and right, that's going to be the medial bone. The lateral one is the fibula, which you can't palpate. Okay, here is the tibial tuberosity. Tuberosity is a process. That's what the patellar ligament inserts into to make the knee joint. Then we have some condylar surfaces on the tibia, which articulate with the condylar surfaces of the femur right here. So here are the epicondyles. Once again, I don't know if you have to know epicondyles for the tibia. I do want you to know that this is a crest on the tibia. And then one other thing, this thing right here that's sticking out medially, that's commonly what we call our ankle bone, but in real life we're going to call that a malleolus. And what bone is this on? The malleolus is on the, okay, this one right here is on the tibia, and the tibia is the medial bone, so this is the medial malleolus. So I don't know, maybe for the next 2 weeks, just walk around all day long and say, medial malleolus on tibia. Medial malleolus on tibia. Somehow, if you don't have photographic memory, you just got to remember that, because you can't understand the anatomy of the knee without knowing what's medial and lateral. Right? So we're going to study the knee real soon. So here's the medial malleolus. And what's the lateral bone in your leg? Fibula. So here is the lateral malleolus. You know, when I was growing up, because your ankle kind of just rotates around, I thought there was like an axle through your ankle, right? That your foot just kind of rotated around. But that's not the case at all, right? It's just that these two malleoli just happen to stick out like that. And we're going to see that there's a bone that fits right into this notch that's made by the fibula and tibia really nicely. What else do you have to know? You know, that's about it for the tibia and as well for the fibula. In lab, I think I want you to know the head versus the lateral malleolus, and I'll show you how to see that in lab. Right, there's no way to describe how to find it by just looking at a two-dimensional picture. The head is more round, the lateral malleolus is more like a blade when we look at it. Okay, so that's bones of the leg. Okay, and again, here you have that interosseous membrane that stabilizes the tibia and fibula. Okay, so again, which of these two, tibia or fibula, which one is medial? Tibia is medial. So here's what, the medial malleolus. Maybe I'll say that in every lecture, okay, because that's really important. It's so easy to forget. And then, you know, if I say it every lecture, then I won't forget it. So you guys will be doing me a favor. All right. We talked about this already. This is an x-ray of the ankle. So here you can see what the lateral malleolus. Here's the medial malleolus right here. Here's a bone that we're going to talk about. We're going to see that this is the talus right here that fits right into that notch. We call this the dome of the talus. But unfortunately, this is kind of an unfortunate individual, because look at the medial malleolus. What is it? Where is it? It's way down here. It's no longer attached to the tibia. That's too bad. So, you know, if you have a lot of sprained ankles or broken an ankle, you probably don't even want to look at this picture. Okay, so here we have the foot. All right, that is the analog of the hand in your lower appendage. And the wrist in your foot is called what? You don't have a wrist in your foot. You have an ankle. Okay, so here are the bones of your ankle. And same number of bones in the ankle as in the wrist. But there are two bones in the ankle that I want you to know. The most superior one, because it helps form the ankle joint with the tibia and fibula, we call that the talus. And then the one that makes up the heel, that strikes the ground every time we take a step, that's the calcaneus. All right, so I want you to know talus and calcaneus. They belong to a group of bones in your ankle, and we cannot call these carpals, because where do you find carpals? In your wrist. So we're going to call these tarsals instead. All right, so carpals are in your wrist, tarsals are in your ankle, and the two that you have to know are the talus and the calcaneus. Talus is important because it forms the articulation with tibia and fibula. Calcaneus is important because that's your heel that you strike the ground on, but it's also important because it's one of the most important bones for controlling the angle of your foot, whether you're lifting your toes up off the ground or pointing your toes into the ground. And when do you point your toes into the ground? Yeah, every time you take a step, real important. Or anytime you run, right? So that's got to be a big, powerful, bony structure, because it's going to hold up all of your weight, whether you strike it when you're walking or if you lift your body up off the ground, it still has to support all your weight because there's muscles that attach there. So here's the talus on a lateral view, and here's the calcaneus on a medial view. All right, so here are the tarsals. Here are the bones that make up the foot. So So what would you call these? Use the same nomenclature. Yeah, metatarsals. And again, they have the same numbering scheme starting with the big toe, right? And big toe is medial. It's the other way around compared to the hand. And then here are your digits. What are the names of the bones that make up your digits? They're phalanges. And again, your big toe only has two. The remaining four have three. Distal, middle, proximal. And this would be what? Number two, counting over from the big toe. Okay, in lab, make sure, next week, make sure you know the difference between a hand and a foot. They're going to look similar. And know how to name all of these bones. So walk up to at least five people and quiz them. Right? Because if you know the right answer, that will help you a lot on the practicum. But make sure you also know the difference between a hand and a foot. Okay, make sure you sign the sign-in sheet, please.